Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because of this international industrial tragedy, there is now an opportunity to have a serious dialogue, you know, about what's going on and how apparel is being made, because the fast fashion is costly.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast. I'm joined today by Dove Charney, founder and CEO of American Apparel, one of the most innovative fashion retailers and brands in the United States, and also a major domestic manufacturer of apparel. Dove, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Dove, you've been in the clothing business for quite a long time. In fact, my understanding is that you started in it as a teenager.
That's correct.
So what brought you into it? What was so compelling about t-shirts?
Well, I had a love for basic white t-shirts, Hanes underwear t-shirts, and they were cotton. The t-shirts available in Canada were poly cotton. I started to bring in a few at a time, and I brought them so my friends could resell them in front of the Montreal Forum. They were bootleg t-shirts.
So this was
as wholesaling the shirts.
So you were a high school student in the United States, and you just started buying them up.
I was buying 50, 100 at a time, reselling them to my friends, smuggling them into Canada and trying to make a dollar a piece. And then I'd also worked with my friends to sell them. So as an employee of two of my friends, as a street vendor, we'd get $50 each and we would sell the t-shirts. Of
course, how old were you when you started doing this?
Oh, I think it was 15 were doing that. Yeah.
Wait, so how were you getting back and forth across the border? I mean, did you have an older friend who was driving you? Or
no, Amtrak. No, you could go. There was used to be two trains a day that would leave New York. Now there's only one. There was the night train and there was the day train.
So, I mean, how are you getting your studies done while you were doing
studies,
this?
Studies was secondary to business. You know? So I was importing the t-shirts, reselling them, and then a few other people said, hey, can you get me some? And the business snowballed. It was a wholesale t-shirt business. There was a printer by the name of Bernie May on the corner of St. Lawrence and Sherbrooke in Montreal. He was a Harley Davidson dealer, and he said, hey, can you get me 1,000 of those? And then another guy said, can you get me 5,000? And all of a sudden, you know, I had a business where I was doing maybe $100,000 a year. There was a time that American Apparel did, I remember it was the first year was 12,000, the next year was 100,000. Eventually we had $100,000 a month.
So then, okay, so you were doing this as a high schooler, you were making major amounts of money as a high schooler.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but you know.
Well, because you were spending a lot too, I guess, in the course of doing it.
Well, you know, my books and records weren't the best. I think I was losing money when I thought I was making money. Every year or two, there was a shoebox of receipts, and I'd like toss it out the window on the highway, start again. You know, trying to make money.
So what
still am.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, it's not shoeboxes anymore, I hope.
No.
But so then what happened next? I mean, so then you kind of, after high school, did you take some time out? Or did you, you know, in college, were you still selling? Were you still in the clothing business?
This has been a continuous stream of consciousness for me since I was 15 or 16 years old, every day.
So one thing just naturally progressed from the other thing. It just...
Yeah. I believed in American iconic t-shirts. I was buying job lots of Hanes t-shirts in South Carolina, in Columbia, South Carolina. I took the train there from Miami. And I met this guy named Klaus Wistrow. And he was a German textile engineer that had come to the United States as an engineer. I really knew what he was doing. He says, he told me we can make our own t-shirts. You know, here's how you do it. And then we took it to a knitter.
We had it knitted up, and then we took it to a fabric finisher to get it bleached and finished, and then we took it to a place called 96 South Carolina, and we went over there, and there was maybe 15 women, and they sewed up the shirts in front of me, and it took a couple of days. I remember the hotels I was staying at the time were like $20 a night. Gas was maybe 75 cents
a
gallon.
That's wild, yeah.
Yeah, it was another time. Anyway, but in South Carolina at that time was like, in 1980, it felt like 1960, you know?
Even then, the domestic garment manufacturing textile sector, you know, was already going through a big transition, right? I mean,
in the early 90s, it was mm-hmm. just starting. So I witnessed the collapse of the apparel and textile industry in North and South Carolina.
And it was still pretty protected back then.
Yeah, but it took about till 1995 and 1996 before it was decimated. But during some sales visits to Los Angeles, because of the companies like Forever 21, the Carolinas was being fueled by Hanes, Fruit Loom, Gilded.
Just the commodity producers.
Right, the commodity t-shirts.
Basics,
but then in California, where I was selling the garments, it became apparent that there was manufacturing going on there. But that manufacturing was more for boutiques like Forever 21.
And that was the really old school proto version of fast fashion. I mean, they were very trend driven, and they're doing little things.
They were much more flexible than the South Carolina guys.
Right.
T-shirts in South Carolina were like 60 cents. And when I came to LA, they were telling me $2. Everything was $2. But then I eventually showed, hey, I'm doing this in South Carolina, and the wages are the same, and I'm paying 60 cents. And I met a guy that said, okay, give me 10,000 pieces. I'll try and do it at the prevailing prices at the prevailing prices you're paying in South Carolina. And that guy eventually became my partner. And I started manufacturing in Los Angeles in the way that one would manufacture in South Carolina.
Got it.
So I was one of the...
The scale was a lot
better. Right, but the cutting equipment in the Carolinas was different than the cutting equipment that was being used in Los Angeles. The way they processed the textiles was different, and I kind of showed people, look, this is how I'm doing in the Carolinas. You want to do it for me, do it like this. I had a $10 million business, so I had a big enough... I was a big enough of a player to show people how I wanted to do it. And still today, there are many companies that adopted the manufacturing techniques that I brought with me from South Carolina. So I kind of infected some of the manufacturing tactics.
When you first got out to LA, when you were first setting up this factory, were a lot of your early employees, I mean, where were they coming from? How did you recruit these guys? Were there people who had already been seamstresses in the area, you know, that kind of thing? I mean, how did you find the employees?
At first, I was using subcontractors in South Carolina. I continued to do the same thing where I would basically buy the yarn, commission dye it, then contract cut and sew it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was vertically integrated subcontractor. We were under the 10 freeway on the Santa Fe exit. Some of those workers from that factory, from that first 60, work with us today.
That's amazing.
Right, we're thousands of people, but there's some people you could see, they remind me, I was with you when we were in there. they know, and I know, but no one else understands that we were under the freeway with one toilet, and you'd hear the trucks on there. It was crazy, you know. It really felt like you were on a journey. The reason I started bringing manufacturing to Los Angeles was the government was actually padlocking a lot of the small contractors that were left over because there was this effort to collect every tax dollar, and some of them were falling behind on their payroll taxes because things were getting very competitive. And because they were losing a lot of contracts to Mexico and to the Caribbean and to eventually to China. So they were struggling along, and the government just kicked them in the teeth. They used to padlock the factory, which was a big fear for me because I'd have all my merchandise in there. So one day on a Friday night, because there's a company called Cross Country Transport, where if you can get to Charlotte by 11:50, we can get your goods into LA by Monday morning. Okay, so they you'd have to, you know, we'd take our own vans there, load up the trucks, and then a caravan of 8 or 10 trucks would go. Boom, they'd go down to Los Angeles. And the company that we're using in South Carolina got padlocked or couldn't do it, or there's something went wrong. I think they got padlocked. I said, put the fabric on that truck. And I said, Kevin, get over there, get it up there. Lo and behold, no one knew how to cut this fabric because it was flat folded. And in LA, they use rolls.
Wow, so it was really by the seat of your pants kind of thing. You were like, I just need to get this out of there because it's falling apart.
I was in panic because I couldn't find a contractor. There was only one guy that really knew how to work with flat. He had an old machine to do it. He had like a, you know, he had a flat fold spreader, and it was my partner, the guy that eventually became my partner, because I had to get this order out because of the deadline.
Yes. So when did it start being kind of a contrarian move for you to want to stick your production, keep your production in the United States, in Los Angeles? Like, around what year did you start seeing that the other folks who were doing the same thing, they started falling away and that you were the...
The mid-90s.
Yeah.
Because still that time, everybody's rolling to Mexico. We're going to make the fabric here. We're going to cut it over there. We're going to bring it back. It was like that. I am a little bit of a control freak. You know, I wanted a certain quality. What made American Apparel happen was our t-shirts were a little bit better than the standard stuff. And even though I was double the price, it was like, okay. And that's, it was through being a little bit ahead, having a little bit of taste, a little bit of foresight. Because I had what they want, I could charge more so. It's like every, you know, and when it comes to t-shirts, okay, so the Hanes t-shirt is $2 and the American Apparel t-shirt was $3.50, but for a $1.50 difference, if I'm at a concert, and I sell 100 of these and 10 of these, well, this is cheaper because I'm getting, my revenue is so much better on the American Apparel product. So that's how we did it, by exploiting art, basically.
So it began, so it began by being, look, this is how I'm making my money. I'm making my money by offering a better product. I better be sure it's a better product. I want the control, and that's why I want to be where it's being manufactured.
Precisely. Yeah. So it wasn't about, people weren't that interested in Made in USA. I mean, there was some interest in it, but it wasn't that interesting because there were some people that were from the, were of the ilk that, doesn't matter where it's made, I want the best value, caveat emptor. I want good price for the customer. But I think I provided that first. It was a good deal. Like, yeah, it's more expensive, but it's better, and here's why.
You know? But, you know, now one of the things you're thinking about and you've been talking about is just about these larger issues, surrounding the economics of the business and what have you. So, I mean, is your, and also you said before, you're an adamant, ardent free trader. You know, you're not looking to kind of throw up tariff barriers or anything like that. You seem totally comfortable with the idea of, you know, other countries manufacturing garments and what have you. But so am I right in saying that what you're saying is that, look, you know, it's fine to do it elsewhere. It happens to be better to do it here. Is that kind of what you're?
Well, it's not about here or there.
Okay, got it.
Okay, what's important is that I believe in bringing the worker into the company. That's the first thing. Okay, knowing the face of the worker. We're not relentlessly pursuing cheap wages in order to get the product made. Okay, and that's interesting. That's interesting, but we're still relentlessly pursuing everything else to make sure we're offering the customer value. Because I don't think we're going to guilt trip the customer into buying our product.
So basically, you know, you're not saying that Made in the USA is going to make someone pay, you know, $2-3 more for a t-shirt. You're saying that, you know, for you as a company, the higher wages, you know, that actually disciplines you and that actually makes you a better company in other regards?
Well, it's like an art project where you're told, okay, you can't, you know, sometimes you're given a piece of charcoal and you have to build, you know, to design a colorful landscape with a black piece of charcoal, but it's possible to give people that feeling. If we're gonna sell clothes, we gotta give them a reason to wanna buy. We have to play up to, it's a good quality, it's gonna make you feel good, it's, you know, it's well draped, it's well cut, it's a good product, it's gonna last a little bit longer. You know, so we have to play up to that, this kind of, you know, the mystique.
This is one thing I want to actually ask you about, and this is one thing that I find fascinating. So when you look, you know, 30 years ago to today, if you want a college education, it costs far more, like something 5 or 6 times more. If you want to stay a night in a hospital, it costs 5 or 6 times more. Clothing is much, much cheaper, and it's enabled a revolution in self-expression. You think about someone growing up in 1980, you know, maybe you had a pair of corduroy pants, you had a pair of jeans, you had, you know, kind of a few shirts, something like that. But now, just, it's an explosion, and it's actually, it seems to have actually changed the texture of our lives.
Yeah.
So, but in a way, you know, when you think about it, well, part of that's manufacturing in Mexico, part of that's manufacturing in China and Bangladesh and Vietnam and Cambodia. That's enabled this kind of freedom.
Yeah, this fast fashion is kind of crass and cheap. Okay, number one, I'll say that. Number two, it's on the backs of other people. I was having a discussion with someone earlier today, and I saw a bus go by with, you know, a guy and a girl. It was an H&M ad. They look like, he looked very handsome and she looked very lovely. And the bus was going by, but the problem is the stuff, you know, it's sexy, it looks sexy, it feels sexy, but it's made in a place, it's basically stolen goods. Hot, they're hot goods. When you buy a brand new TV set and it's stolen, It doesn't feel quite right, you know? It's not right.
But there's another issue here. So, you know, Bangladesh is a country where, you know, and this has obviously been the big controversy because mm-hmm. of the factory having collapsed. Mm-hmm. You know, over 1,000 people have died. I mean, it's obviously mm-hmm. a massive mm-hmm. human tragedy. On the other hand, when you look at Bangladesh from the 70s, when the whole garment manufacturing trade got started there, to now, you know, the level of poverty has gone from 70% to 40%. You've got 3.5 million people working in the garment manufacturing mm-hmm. sector. Average incomes have gone from about $1 a day to $5 a day. And a lot of that's driven by the garment manufacturing stuff. So, I mean, I definitely see what you mean. You know, these are wages, these are labor standards that we would obviously consider totally unacceptable in the United States. On the other hand, you know, when you go to Cambodia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, mm-hmm. these countries, it does seem like the fact that, you know, we have fast fashion, we have this stuff here, it does seem to have actually driven some progress there too.
Yeah, that's the upside. But the thing is that when we come to grips with, I think a lot of people don't understand what sweatshops are. I've tried to explain it to people. I've been in and out of sweatshops all my life. There are sweatshops in Los Angeles. I'm familiar with them. I can tell you. We can go look at them tomorrow if you want to fly there tonight. But and there are certainly sweatshops in Mexico. I've been in them and been in and out of them. And I've been in sweatshops all over the world. But I'll tell you one thing, that if it's a sexy piece coming out of a sweatshop, there's a reputational risk. And it just doesn't feel good. No one wants, you know, you don't want a sexy pair of underwear, you know, or lingerie to be made in a slave-like setting. So that's one of the downsides over time of using sweatshops. But there's also an economic thing is that there's not going to be cheap labor forever. The world wages will harmonize as we globalize the economy, as there's a free flow of money, as we eventually liberalize the movement of people. Okay. You know, the invisible hand will create a scenario whereby we may not have these cheaper wages in Bangladesh. So in the long term, what's really smart is to...
That's the very, very, very long term, though, right?
Right.
I mean, I think that... And it's funny because what
right.
you're saying partly...
Do you think that clothing will be made by hand in 100 years?
No.
Me neither.
Although, actually, one thing I do wonder...
I mean, some of it will be, but, you know, there's going to be machines. A guy sent me a video of an idea he had. He's been, you know, he's got money from the New York Department of Energy. He has this machine where the fabric rolls in this thing and it bonds the t-shirt drops to the ground, and another machine puts it over here. I mean, it's not gonna be forever. It's not, even though we pay workers $30,000 a year, and not all workers, but many of them earn, you know, experienced workers earn to the wage levels like that. And if you have two partners that are living together, it's a household income of $60,000 and they're working in American Apparel. You know, $60,000 can get you to places in Los Angeles. Just get you a fair apartment, a car, internet, et cetera, right? We're paying a fair wage, but it's still hard labor. Now, I make a good wage. You could pay me my salary, I wouldn't sell t-shirts. It's not a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay, pay a fair wage, we're committed to that, and there's a lot of smiles at American Apparel, and I love my workers, but it's not something I think that will be done for the next 100 years. Okay, no, you're sitting there on a machine. The reason we haven't automated the apparel industry is because we always have cheaper labor, so it doesn't pay. There was a company called Atlanta Attachment that used to come up with all these automated devices.
Yeah.
We still use their devices at American Apparel. They've gotten out of the racket because a lot of this automation just get cheap. Go to Bangladesh, you don't need
it. It is a fascinating issue. I mean, you see it, you know, when people talk about, for example, agricultural labor. I mean, to some degree, well, if the wages were sufficiently high, we'd find machines to do it. But yeah, I mean, to some extent, it is just a matter of if you have cheap labor available, you'll use it instead of more expensive labor. But I mean, I wonder, so it seems that on one level, you're saying that, look, it's actually a reputational risk. It's a brand risk issue.
There's some of that.
But I also wonder, I mean, so one argument for higher wages is the Henry Ford argument, right? The Henry Ford argument that, you know, to some extent, you know, these are the folks who are buying the products as well, and, you know, kind of we want to pay them higher wages, also because they're going to be more efficient, they're going to be more productive, there's going to be less turnover if we pay people higher wages. Is that
okay,
part of the
motivation? Okay, that's a marble on my side.
Yeah.
Okay? The Henry Ford argument. Then the reputational one's a marble on my side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you find that that's actually true? I mean, do you find that kind of by paying a little bit more, you get less turnover and that?
Of course, of course. You get the right people in, you train them, you keep them, you retain them. They become really good at making belts and T-shirts and shoes.
So I mean, when in your factory, I mean, are folks over? You know, if they're working there for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, are they moving up the ladder? I mean,
I have a guy that was with me when we had 200 workers, and now he runs the factory. His name is Jeremiah. I remember he was on a sewing machine.
Yeah.
And now, you know, he runs around and like everybody's chasing this guy. Yeah, Aramis, can you help me do this? You know, but he would, you know, there is a ladder of opportunity in the apparel industry. There's a ladder of opportunity in our building. 10 years ago, I used to say American Apparel supports an international minimum wage. I could provide that to you. 10 years ago. At times we backed off the sweatshop free thing because we didn't want to like, we didn't want to drown people with it because we thought we had a great enough product that it could stand on its own. I must say that one rarely should say positive things about one's own team, but we really did build something important and different in Los Angeles, and we deserve more credit than we've gotten. The way we're going to prove it is to make this business as profitable as the very best apparel companies that are paying almost nothing.
Some people would say, I mean, this is a historical process. I mean, if you were in the Lower East Side, you know, in 1905, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you had garment manufacturing that was going on down there that yeah. did not look pretty.
Yeah.
But that was an essential step. And then basically, you know, 20, 30 years later, you had those guys who were in the Lower East Side moving out to Brooklyn and Queens, buying a single family house, climbing the ladder, their yeah. kids are accountants.
Yeah,
that's the way it works.
My Bobby was a garment worker.
Yeah.
She made $7 a week. $7 a week.
So then I guess part of the argument is that, look, you know, maybe what we're seeing in Cambodia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, yeah. these countries is they're just at that stage of the historical process.
Right.
And we've got to let that happen. And we've got to, you know, and that in a way, by short-circuiting that process and saying that, you know, by saying to Bubby, you know, in 1905, sorry, this isn't acceptable, you know, because we think that this is slavery.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that this is unacceptable. And we're not going to let you do this. You know, I mean, you know, in a way, you know, maybe you're short-circuiting this process through which the Cambodians of the world are slowly going to climb that ladder. You know, you can't have them all do it at once. You know, you're going to have the different wages, the different standards. Do you buy that argument? Do you think
I buy that argument to a degree, but I think that, you know, these corporations like H&M is a $22 billion corporation. They've amassed an enormous amount of wealth. They don't have to have their hands dirty to the extent that they do. The number one thing that these companies, I do private label manufacturing for other companies. I've done jobs for Levi's. I've done jobs for JCPenney. I've done third-party work. Let me tell you the biggest problem in the apparel industry is that there's all the contracts are short-term. That's one of the things that keep sweatshops is they never can invest in the equipment. They can't make the long-term investment.
You know, that's exactly what the Bangladeshi garment manufacturers are saying. They're saying that you're giving us a hard time for this, but, you know, we have these tiny margins, and
they
we get massively punished if we don't turn something
they
in
do.
On
Let
time.
Me tell yeah. you what they're dealing with, because I've been a Bangladeshi third-party garment contractor to a degree. Are you making garments for Levi's, et cetera? There's a deadline. You miss that deadline, take the goods, they're yours, and if you sell them, we'll sue you, okay?
Yeah.
So you basically have, you know, especially if they're printed with the swoosh, you're not going anywhere, okay? You sell that anywhere, we're gonna take your children and they will be punished, okay? And we will not pay you anything,
yeah.
okay? So you could be sure they were hustling everybody back in the building because of deadlines. Now, if these garment manufacturers are serious, I'll challenge them to the following. Put a clause in their on all of their purchase orders and their letters of credit. It will completely destabilize the financial system, by the way, okay? Because no one will know what's going on. That if there's a human hardship involved with this particular order of gloves or this particular order of leggings or whatever, that if you have to be late because of a human hardship, call up this 1-800 number from Bangladesh, 1-800 Bangladesh help, okay? And we'll put you on the phone with H&M and we'll review the human circumstances of the situation and get you an extension.
Yeah.
All of a sudden the cost of fast fashion is going up because you know what? The bathing suits didn't show up on May 15th. They came in September 15th because there was a building that was about to collapse. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Well, you're stuck, you know what I mean? H&M's going to be stuck with all these bathing suits that they'll have to sell next year or they'll have to get rid of.
So you now have a coalition of retailers, and it's been a lot of the big European retailers who signed mm-hmm. up, and the Americans
yeah.
have been more reluctant to do so. But we're saying that, okay, we're going to agree to a code on safety and building safety and fire safety. You know, they're saying that, you know, we're going to spend up to $500,000 to upgrade these factories.
$500,000?
Well, that's what they're claiming. So
it's going to require billions. $500 million would have cost me to paint my factory. I mean, I don't know where they come up with half a million.
Yeah, they're saying up to $500,000 for upgrades, you know, kind of for different facilities.
Look, these clowns have to give provisions for extensions. When you listen to some of the media, some of the interviews, when there were labor disputes, why do you think they're going and shooting people in the head if there's labor stoppages? Because they're going to get stuck with the goods. You know what it is to get stuck with the goods? I've been in that circumstance.
Well, actually, and that's part of it.
I got to tell you, I've faced financial disaster when I've had these cancellations. I had an order that I was doing for Target many years ago. I was paralyzed. It almost crushed me.
Is this the responsibility of the consumers then? I mean, should the consumers actually be stepping up and saying that, you know what, I try to eat organic local produce. I now want to be sure that my clothing does not entail these kinds of draconian requirements. You know, I mean, is that, should it be done by the consumers?
You know what?
It seems to me that
the real people that have to get the job done, it's about the business leaders. At my competitors, I call upon them to do exactly what it said. If they do it, they're men, but they're mice. The thing is, you have to be able to tell. See, I deliver to myself, so if I'm late, no one notices. We realize, oh my God, we just got the bathing suits in. Late deliveries, cost overruns. We bear the brunt of that when we just hurt ourselves. But they've put such strong delivery dates on these suppliers that if these suppliers are late, they're going to get hung, they're out of business. So if it's a choice between putting people in a dangerous building, back in the building, or crushing a union versus going bankrupt, they're going towards crushing the union or taking some risks with health and safety.
So, but you don't think that the consumers are the ones who have to drive this change? Because, you know,
I think that there can be now, because of this international industrial tragedy, there is now an opportunity to have a serious dialogue, you know, about what's going on and how apparel is being made, because the fast fashion is costly. When you see these buses rolling by or these signs that say bikini $4.99, I'm telling you, I'm an expert in the apparel industry. $4.99 doesn't exist unless you're screwing someone. That's it. Okay, a $4.99 bikini. Wake up. Okay, that's like saying, hey, got a hamburger for 10 cents. I mean, just, you know, I got it. It costs money to make things. So.
Is there some middle way? Here's what I want to throw out. So, I mean, if you believe that the fact that, you know, garment manufacturing is happening in the developing world, this is something that is actually a sign of human progress. It's helping some of these countries get ahead. It's helping alleviate poverty in these societies. Is there some way to say, okay, you know, pay a little bit more for your T-shirt?
Why doesn't H&M say, we'll pay $100 a month, not 50, you know, we'll pay $200 a month. What about $50 a week? Can H&M afford $50 a week? They shouldn't be making clothing. If they can't pay $50 a week, they'll make clothes. $50 a week, $10 a day, 5 days a week. We're going to make sure that anybody making our clothes, H&M, what's the minimum wage in Stockholm? All right? Why don't they give the minimum wage, these guys, okay? Talk in Stockholm about all this socialism. It's about me, all the workers' rights. It's all for Sweden, you know? But we'll import everything else, right?
Yeah.
It's a form of apartheid in many of these socialist, you know, countries with very high wages. They secretly are doing it on the backs of it. They want to say, look, whatever the hourly minimum wage is in Sweden, we're going to offer that as a daily minimum wage to the workers in Bangladesh.
Although, let's see if they're willing to do that. One issue is that the productivity of an hourly worker in Sweden has got to be so much higher than the productivity of an hourly worker
in Cambodia. Yeah, I'd like to see a Swede make a T-shirt. Okay, we'll see. But that's not really acting. That's a lot of talk. Okay, we're going to pay $15 a day. Let's go to the U.S. minimum wage.
Yeah.
Okay? The minimum wage. We're going to pay, $8 an hour is the California minimum wage. We'll pay $8 an hour in Bangladesh. We got a $22 billion company. We'll lead the way. No, they won't do it because they're paying $40 a month.
They're paying $10 a week.
They're paying $2
I believe it was $40 a month and now they're going to raise it. But the thing is,
they're going to raise it to $46. I mean, it's $2. It's going to go to $3. What's $3 a day?
The reason why the hourly wage is a lot higher in the United States is also because of you have the capital, right? I mean, you have the machine, you have the tools and what have you. It's not necessarily
these guys are making some of the richest men in Europe are the men that own these companies, that have founded these companies. These are not this is not a guy like me, you know. I'm willing, if you want, I'll put all of my bank statements on your show. You could put them up. Let's see if the guy from H&M, the founders of H&M, or the people that are backing H&M are willing to show, disclose what they're earning, show their tax returns, okay? Show what they got tucked away in their Swiss accounts, okay? These guys are making too much bloody money to not be able to pay a single out the minimum hourly wage is a daily wage in Sweden.
Okay, but if I'm H&M
in Bangladesh.
If I'm H&M and I make that move, okay, and if I decide that I'm gonna pay the higher wages, then you know, Inditex and Zara comes along and says, well, we're not gonna do it, right? And then they just
If they're forced to do it? What happens if they're like left out in the cold, looking like they're the ones with the apartheid oranges?
Oh well, okay. But here's the thing. Okay, but if you're saying,
I mean, eventually, no one wanted to buy Utzman oranges in London and Montreal and Toronto. They didn't have Utzman oranges in the States, but we had citrus from South Africa. It was like, no way.
Because we just decided that apartheid was just too ugly.
And eventually, people would not eat Utzman oranges. My mother, when she saw my grandmother had bought Utzman oranges, eventually, it's like, throw them out.
Okay, but here's the thing. Okay, so the thing is that if you're imposing Swedish wages, you know,
I'm saying only what? Take the hour for the day.
No, fair enough. But if you have a big increase in wages before, you know, Cambodia or Bangladesh gets to that point where they're sufficiently productive, right? Then that's just going to mean you're going to go from having 3.8 million garment workers to having, you know, a few hundred.
What if it starts pushing? What if they start, you know, running into some, what if there's a movement to set an international minimum wage for clothing workers? That's what we really need. I have a minimum wage. My minimum wage, okay, take a look at the bear on the flag. California, they set the wages at American Apparel.
Yeah.
Okay, Sacramento, thank you very much. Okay, that's it. Those are my minimum wages. I live by them and I still make money, okay? I have positive cash flow. We intend to make $47 to $52 million of EBITDA this year. We put out a guidance, that's our guidance. We're gonna generate about $50 million of positive cash flow in American Apparel, okay? But we are paying the wage by the bear. Why don't they set a minimum wage for themselves? Some of these major, they're talking about signing something. Sign something that has teeth, real money. We're gonna fix the toilets.
Yeah.
You're gonna make sure the building doesn't come down? Like, God, that's the only thing. Pay.
But I mean, here's the thing is that, okay, if you do that, if you do kind of raise that, let's say you set this international minimum wage, so I mean, one concern then is that you're gonna have a situation in which the Indonesias, the Chinas are gonna be winning out at the expense of the Cambodias and the Bangladeshis,
right? Really?
The countries, the countries
China's
that are less
on
productive.
The run. I am an employer in China.
Yeah.
Okay? Let me tell you what's going on in China. The wages are like,
they're going up a lot
every month.
Yeah.
Every month you gotta pay a little bit more.
But absolutely, but
China's on fire.
But that's what I mean is that you're going to have a situation in which you have the countries in the developing world that are the most productive, you know, they're going to be picking up the ladder, right? And then leaving the countries that are not productive behind.
Yeah, but it's nothing wrong. I'm only saying,
yeah,
let's give them, what is it? I just called upon $2 an hour.
Yeah.
If they can't pay $2 an hour, $3 an hour, whatever it is, get the hell out of business. I mean, or re-engineer that you're saying, oh, well, maybe it may destabilize. Well, you know, if we didn't have minimum wages in the United States, I mean, wouldn't have all the jobs ran to Detroit, you know, where they had 25% of.
But the one thing about, you know, okay.
Nothing wrong with a little safety net, especially if it's industry imposed by themselves, by the very richest of companies.
I think the case for a safety net is very strong, but part of the issue is that, you know, you see wages rise as productivity rises in a society, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And society is rising partly because you have an accumulation. You have an accumulation of human capital, you have an accumulation of infrastructure.
Right now, if you say we're not going to work with factories that don't pay at least $2 to $3 an hour, you set a number. I don't want to set it on this show, but let's say let's call $2 as a start, and then you raise it incrementally. I mean, I don't think that will change the ebbs and flows of how everything happens in this industry. I don't think suddenly people are going to be leaving Bangladesh and going back to China.
Well,
Let
me throw out a possibility. Okay, so what if?
Because the reason they're in Bangladesh isn't just for the price; it's for scale. Okay? I can make t-shirts, you know, that's for scale. That's why Bangladesh is now the second largest producer of clothes. And by the way, Bangladesh has got it. And where's it? Oh, maybe if, yeah. I mean, I understand, maybe they don't get to Sub-Saharan Africa now, you know what I'm saying? But maybe Sub-Saharan Africa does something better anyway. you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the thing that I have a trouble, because I think I'm very, a lot of what you're saying, I think, makes a lot of sense. I think that my concern is...
Okay, do you condone slavery?
Absolutely not.
Okay, then you have to support what I'm saying. I mean, there's, I mean...
Well, but here's the thing, though.
I mean, come on, you're gonna, I'm not telling you it has to be 50 yeah. bucks an hour. I'm not saying it's gotta yeah. be $7 an hour.
Yeah.
I'm saying $2 an hour. They're not even paying these people. Let's see, they say $40, they said $40 a month, right? Yeah. And how many hours does a man work? 160 if they're working 40 hours yeah. a week, but we think they're working more. How much is the, like,
let's just 20 cents an hour.
20 cents an hour?
Yeah, 21 cents an hour.
20 cents an hour is slavery.
Well, okay, but here, and so you're talking, in Bangladesh, you're talking about a country with 150 million people, okay?
Yeah.
And you're talking about people who are going from subsistence agriculture. Right,
which might be higher wages if they might be going home with a bushel of corn that's worth more.
They don't think so. They don't think so. I mean, that's why they're going to the cities. That's why they're streaming into the cities. You know, you see this happening in Africa. You see this happening in. You see this happening all over the place. I mean, they're and also, you know, it's similar.
You know what? H&M could afford to pay $2 an hour.
Okay, so let's say H&M, you know? Okay.
And then so maybe they're not going to have. It's not going to say $4.99, and maybe their EBITDA margins.
Okay.
Maybe their net profits, their shareholders yeah. are going to start to, you know, show. A little bit of strain, but you know, they can advertise harder, they can design better. You know, let's see if Forever 21, you know, you take H&M, Forever 21, Primark, you take all these discount retailers and you say, hey guys, can you afford a $2 per hour wage? Okay. If you can't.
Dove, let's say, okay, I buy this. Okay, so let's say, just for argument's sake,
yeah.
that I'm a consumer. In New York, LA, Stockholm, whatever, and I believe that, you know, I'm not comfortable with what H&M's doing, so H&M, they have to pay this higher wage. Then you've got some company, a startup company yeah. in Cambodia,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And the Cambodian company says, okay, you know, H&M isn't gonna exploit us. We Cambodians are gonna make our own clothes. We're gonna pay the
yeah,
you know, local prevailing wage.
Yeah, but they won't have the seal, you know, the seal yeah. with it. They'll yeah, be exactly. like a little exactly, heart
exactly,
or something.
Exactly, but then
they, you know, I mean, they don't have that little heart yeah, on okay. the label, though.
Okay,
know?
But then, you know, but would that be okay with you if then it's not H&M, it's not the Swedes coming
yeah,
in and exploiting
probably
people?
Probably a bogus startup out of Cambodia coming to sell clothing in the United States and doing their own retailing?
Yeah, I mean, but would you be okay with that? Because
at least,
not the Swedes coming and exploiting the Cambodians.
Let me tell you what's, going on in retail. New York City is a shopping mall. Independent yeah. retail is being set aside.
Yeah.
Okay, each lease is controlled. But Chipotle next door, we have a Duane Reade and a Basad over yeah. here. We're thinking you, American Apparel, could come in over here. You have an H&M over here. I mean, come on, it's being colonized, okay, by these massive multi-billion-dollar companies. That they can't afford to pay $2 an hour, shame on them. That's the thing.
But if you have a Cambodian company in Cambodia that's
talking
saying
about for assembly only, I'm not even talking about yeah. textiles, okay? I'm just talking about the assembly of the apparel product.
But you get what I'm coming from. So if it's the Cambodian, like, forget about the Swedes exploiting Cambodians. The Cambodians deciding, you know, this is the wage we can afford to pay. We're gonna try to make it big. We're gonna try to sell and stuff. Because, you know, you said yourself, you're not a big fan of borders, right? So, I mean, you know, it's not about someone coming
in. I think they can handle it.
You think they can handle it?
Yeah, because the amount of money that they have, they control the real estate. Okay? It's not easy to just waltz in and open all these stores. They control the supply chain. They control the distribution centers. They control the shipping companies, okay? I know it. I control, like, JetBlue Airways, okay? The air freight from LA to New York, I control that lane as best I can, okay? No one's muscling in on my spot. I gotta get the stuff out of Los Angeles into the streets of New York 7 days a week. If there's a disruption to that delivery flow, I'm ballistic at 9:30 in the morning, okay? I mean, so the H&M controls various aspects of the apparel industry, okay?
The way that I think about globalization sometimes is this. You have a world in which some countries exist in the year 2013, and you've got some countries that are in 1920, some that are in 1950, some that are in 1800, okay?
And some that are 2020.
Right, exactly. So, you know, and the thing is that, you know, when you have these countries that are in 1850, to say to them, we want you to operate according to 1975 rules, you know, in the United States, you know, they're not going to be able to do it. They're not going to be able to hack it. They're not going to be able to actually enter and take advantage of this global economy.
You cannot allow for slave wages to be paid in the apparel industry. It's not acceptable. It can't be sustained. You're saying, well, slavery is okay.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, you know, you
eventually the world said, no apartheid, not going to have it. They've got to say no wages that are below a certain level. That's it. If you're gonna play the manufacturing game, you gotta pay even a buck an hour. We'll go dollar an hour. Okay, but four times.
But Doug, you're talking about safety nets, and that's fair enough. Here's the thing: if you're gonna do that, but then you don't also have global redistribution. Okay.
This is global redistribution.
Well, but if you're pricing folks out of being on the bottom rungs of the economic ladder, Sub-Saharan Africa, these countries that aren't even there yet. You know, they're not even where Cambodia is yet. They're not even where Vietnam is yet. And if you're saying that, look, you know, it's slave labor, we're not going to let you do it. But then to them, you know, I'm in the Kalahari Desert, you know, okay, otherwise I'm wandering around, you know,
hey, doing
some
subsistence agriculture. Hey, but you don't let me do it. I mean, I can't hire you. If I want to pay you $6.50 an hour, which is what you're worth.
But you're not going to do it for fun.
No, you're not going to take the job at $6.50.
Yeah.
No, you will take the job. You know how many young people would say, sure, I'll be your assistant for $7 an hour. I want to be Dove Charney's assistant for $7 an hour, but I can't hire you at $7 an hour. I got to pay you $8. You're a California worker.
Yeah.
I can't label you as an intern. They said in California, no more interns. You heard about this thing? You have to be, an internship has to be for real credit. You can't, for school credit. You can't just call them an intern. It's a labor violation. You know, according to Sacramento, you're not allowed to do it. Okay? So you say, I just want to be your intern. You don't have to pay me. Sorry, you can't work
it
as an intern.
It took hundreds of years for California to get to that place.
I'm just saying, there's certain minimum standards we have. And you know what? There's more billionaires in California than anywhere else. Okay? Life
didn't happen overnight. They didn't get from the Kalahari Desert. They didn't get from Senegal.
Yeah,
they didn't get to California.
Yeah, but California is,
you know,
California is a leader in terms of wage and hour laws, okay? You have the 8-hour workday in California. You have so many employee-favored laws there.
Yeah.
Yet California is prosperous. I mean, you know.
Well, not everyone would agree with you there.
I think they're
bleeding talent. They're bleeding.
Yeah.
But
okay. Ask them at Google or Yahoo or all these big companies to go over to Palo Alto and drive through.
Well, yeah,
town.
But you know, but like every single employee of Apple is generating hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue, right?
Yeah.
Every employee, you know, who's working in that factory at Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, they are not generating, you know, over $500,000 in revenue, okay?
Actually, they are. They're generating a lot
not
of revenue.
What I'm saying is that if
it's
you're looking
going
at a company
to the
like
malls. It's going to, look, what's happening in my industry, because I have to compete to hire all these people, okay? The administrative employees in the apparel industry are making six-figure salaries and beyond, okay? The malls, okay? Right now, there's a big thing going on in Las Vegas. It's the mall. They have like, you know, I think it's called the ICSC. It's where all the mall owners are. They're taking out one of my guys to dinner right now. Let's go to Morton's, okay? Everybody's fat and happy. Or everybody's fat and happy in retail and in the real estate industry that's supporting the retail industry. All the agents are happy. Everybody's feeling great. By the way, they had a nice little whorehouse, I heard, in the building, okay, where they were doing drugs, cocaine, all kinds of things they talked about was going on the ground floor, okay, below where all the workers were. So it's a little bit insane to think that we can't say, look, we've had a disaster here, okay, what would they have to pay, okay? What would they have to pay if this disaster took place in the United States? How many billion dollars would they have to pay out a building? Imagine the American Apparel building falls down, okay? I mean, what am I going to have to pay? What is going to be left over for me? Okay? Yeah. I mean, come on. You know, the least they could do is start to set minimum. We're not going to buy any apparel in Bangladesh unless we're paying so much money. We're going to put a clause in every purchase order that allows it if there's a human hardship involved in us executing this order. We want a hearing before an H&M advisory board to see if we can get an extension or an industry-sponsored advisory.
But it's also true.
And no one
it's also true that you're a successful guy, okay?
Yeah,
you've done
a
lot of things. You've built a substantial, enduring business, okay? So, you know, if you're going to take out an insurance policy on your life, you know, you're going to be able to take out a much bigger one than a guy who, has led a lackadaisical life, hasn't amounted to much. You know, I mean, it's just kind of a, you know, in that crude sense,
that neither
of us is comfortable with, there is a crude sense. I don't like it, you don't like it, but there's a crude sense of which your life is quote unquote worth more.
Well, how much is, what's the minimum value of life today in the world?
We have to have
a minimum value.
Yeah, well, that's a deeply uncomfortable and problematic idea, and you're right, and you've taken it.
How much money should the retailers pay for each life in Bangladesh? I was thinking about it today. What's your answer?
Well, look, my answer is whatever is gonna get that country out of the poverty trap it's in. And that means that, you know,
No, but what, okay. Your mother got killed in the collapsed building. You now have standing to sue them in the United States court. I'm not saying you do, but you might. But let's say you walk in to a New York, a New York City courtroom. What kind of judgment do you think you're entitled to?
I'm sure millions.
Yeah, well, what are they going to get? Here,
well, they're going to get barely anything. But here's what you're saying, Dove, is that the world is unfair, and
I'm
no
not
one disputes
the world's
that.
Unfair. Well, but here, I think that these retailers need their assets.
Okay,
and that's going to force them to think a little bit.
You and I both grew up. We were both born in North America. Okay, that doesn't make you a better human being that someone was born in Mexico or Germany. Okay, I'm going to throw it out there. It doesn't make you a better human being.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, but. The sad fact is that simply by virtue of being born in Canada or the United States, your life is treated as more valuable. And why is that? It's because for hundreds of years, this has been a developed, affluent society, and then we benefit from that inheritance. And the thing is that, you know, if there are countries, going back to this time travel idea, if there's a country that's in 1850 or 1750, you know, they don't have the benefit of that inheritance,
but I'm saying,
and they're trying to get on the bottom rungs of the ladder.
We're all in 2012.
Yeah.
Okay, number one. Number two, okay, I don't know. It's not, when you go there, it's not, the clock doesn't suddenly say 1850. Right. Okay, we're in 2012. These are international companies. We're in 2013. What's the matter with me? Okay, we're in 2012.
Time travel is happening right before our eyes. Okay.
So,
yeah.
With me, I'm always a year behind. Okay, anyway, so we're in 2014.
Slow fashion.
13.
Yeah.
Right. We're in 2013.
Yeah.
These guys had a building fall. Their contracts were in there. This is not the first industrial accident. This is the second one. And then a week later, there was like another one.
But look, the wages are higher there now than they were five years ago, right?
I gotta tell you something.
Yeah, okay.
They've gotta pay. If they're gonna make clothes and sell them to rich people in Toronto and London and New York, they better get their act together, or they're engaging in death trap manufacturing. Period. Okay? Death trap manufacturing. It's going on. Loblaws is a major operator.
What about my liberty to work in the factory? I'm in the Kalahari Desert and I'm like, you know, it sucks being a herder. You know, kind of, there's a drought. Mm-hmm. This stinks. Mm-hmm. You know, what about my liberty to work in the factory for the lower wage?
I mean, you're going to get screwed hard enough getting paid a buck or two an hour. I mean, 20 cents is too hard of screwing. We shouldn't even allow it. Just like I'm not allowed to hire you as an intern in California, even if you want to be hired. I'm sure there's a young kid there. I just wanted to be an intern. Okay? And I couldn't be. I wanted to be an intern at the LA Weekly, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's too bad. You're not going to get to be an intern unless they pony up $8 an hour.
So I have a sense. I have a sense of how you're looking at this, and it makes
sense. I'm talking about the minimum. I'm talking about free liberty, freedom, you know, commercial freedom for everyone, but with a basic no slavery allowed.
I want to talk to you about, tell me about where you want American Apparel to go next, okay? So, you know, are you thinking that you guys have the right model, H&M has the wrong model because it's, as you say, built on slavery? So what you're saying is that we have the right model, and is that why you think you guys are going to succeed and flourish? Because you're doing the right thing and consumers are going to reward you for doing the right thing?
Well, if I had a group of 10 MBA students from Harvard University over here and we were going over, I've already broken the sweatshop paradigm. Now, because I have enough, I mean, you have to have an imagination and scale American Apparel. I'm only did $617 million last year, and you have to imagine, well, if the company does $1 billion and you scale everything and each door does about 20% more, and you know, the internet business doubles, and you figure that we could probably, you know, probably get 300-500 basis points out of our margin once we scale the business, what does the profitability look like? It looks like they did break the sound barriers as far as not having to rely on slave wages to assemble. Okay? So we've already accomplished that, but for the world to see it, we've got to really boom. I gotta make a certain level.
So is that your mission right now? Your mission is to demonstrate that you can succeed without relying on...
Right. My mission... Well, I already have demonstrated in my point of view. If you carefully dissect my... You know, it's a little bit foggy and there's hair on the story, but if you carefully dissect my financial statements, I've landed the plane. Now I got to scale it. I got to take it from $617 million to $1,000 million approximately, at about $1,000 or $1,100 million. Which is $1 billion to $1.2 billion, it starts to really make sense. So if I scale it, and how do I scale it? It means I have a store over here in Williamsburg, I gotta sell about 20% more per store, which is about $1,000 a day, okay? per store worldwide, every store, every day, 365. It's got to go up a grand a store. Then I've got to double my internet business. Okay, I'm doing about 50, 60, 70 million on the internet. I got to double it. Okay, then I got to bring up my margin 4 or 5%. That's like $1.50 a piece. Either, you know, whether lower some costs or raise some selling, whatever. And this company will be worth a multiple $1 billion. And I'll be able to say, boom, we did it without, we leveraged art, design, technology, marketing, what have you.
Are machines part of the story? Are more machines in the factory kind of relying more heavily on, I mean,
No, but we've automated our distribution center.
Yeah.
Which so far has been a disaster the first 5 weeks in, but you know, it should get better, okay? Yeah, that's the way it goes when you automate. You know, there are all kinds of, we'll continuously automate over the next 25 years. But when I hit 80 years old, I want to say I was an avant-garde thinker. The boy didn't rely on slave wages to get it done. And maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't as glamorous. You know, I wasn't over there at the, you know, in the helicopter or anything, you know. Or I didn't have, you know, the private jumbo jet or whatever, but I got it done.
Have you always felt this strongly about this? Because, you know, it seems when you were first talking, you were saying, like, look, we cared about the quality, we had the better t-shirt, and that's
well,
why
I've been in and out of it, you know.
So
on some days I'm like you, I'm lover to leave it, you know, competitive. But on other days there's a little bit of compassion, you know, so I bark and then I hug and then I think and I love and I bark and I, you know, it's like I'm like a dog, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm a loving dog,
so
but I'm competitive.
So what did you think when you heard that the factory collapsed in Bangladesh? What was your immediate reaction when you heard that? I mean, because it sounds to me as though, you know,
I was very sad for those people because I know what it is to work on a sewing machine. Not only did my grandmother work on a sewing machine, but I know I have people that work for me that are on a sewing machine. So I know it's serious work, it's sweating labor for 20 cents an hour, it's a shame, it's an embarrassment, and that they didn't even keep a proper building, you know. I know they got screwed. I know they got screwed by the relentless pursuit of low cost in my industry, okay? You could have a great ad campaign, could promote, we know it in the fragrance industry, that, you know, a great ad campaign from a crap ad campaign makes all the difference. They could put the money into marketing. They could put the money, they could get the value out of this differently. They don't have to screw a 26-year-old woman in Bangladesh to get it done. It's too hard, man. They went too far. And it just, I was sad for the lives. I was hoping, okay, I heard 100 people. Shit, that's real bad, 100 people. But then it went to 200. I was like, oh my God, 200. 300, 400, then 700, then 1,100 people. I think the CEOs of the top 50 apparel companies should be coming together and have a talk about it, you know? 1,100 people? I mean, only 3,000 people got hit in the World Trade Center, and we talk about it every day in the United States. It's like, you know, when you see the flag on the subway, you think about that. You know, when you see the flag on a Greyhound bus, when you go to the airport, you feel it, okay? You feel September 11th. This is a September 11th, I think, for the apparel industry and for the working people of apparel. I mean, we've had we still talk about a fire. I think it's the triangle, what's it called?
Yeah, the triangle shirtwaist.
Shirt. So now we're in 2013, it's 100 years later. This is, that changed the industry. And why can't they now pledge to have mechanisms for extensions, okay? There has to be mechanisms for extensions on short-term contracts in the apparel industry, and there has to be a minimum wage set.
Okay, I want to ask you, so there are going to be some young people watching this, young people who, you know, buy a lot of fast fashion. It's an important part of their life. It's an important part of their self-expression, mm-hmm. their creativity. What's your message to them? You know, person who is buying clothes from these folks who are relying on workers in the developing world earning very, very low wages, sometimes potentially in unsafe conditions. What's your message to that 15-year-old, that 25-year-old, you know, who's buying that bikini for $4.99, who is buying, what's your message to them?
One, nothing's black and white. Don't take anything I've said as truth. Don't take anything that you said as truth. Don't, you know, but open your mind and think about where things are coming from. And also think about how you want to construct your own life and what impact you might want to make when you own your own business or work in another company. And how, and I think what's most exciting about being a young person today is try to construct a business or trying to get involved with business activities or commercial activities that that whereby everyone touched by the business process has a positive experience. That's Deming. There's a business philosopher by the name of Deming. Is it Arthur Deming? I forgot the first name.
I thought it was William, but he was loved in Japan.
Continuous improvement. Yeah, continuous improvement. And one of the things he says, forget about the bottom line sometimes. Just focus on making sure that everyone touched by the business process has a positive experience. And those are the things you want to buy into. Those are the things you want to that's the kind of energy you want to collaborate with and focus on that. Nothing's black and white, and it doesn't mean don't shop at H&M. That's not the story, okay? It doesn't mean come shop to American Apparel because I'd be lying to you, okay? but be aware of who you are and what you're doing and how you can contribute to life, and just keep an open mind.
When you were 15 years old and you were hustling and you were moving huge suitcases full of Hanes t-shirts on the Amtrak to Montreal, what would you have made of where you are right now and what you're doing right now? Do you think that the 15-year-old Dove would have been proud of the Dove now? I'm the CEO of American Apparel.
I don't know, I'm linked, I'm still 15. Right now, I don't know. I don't know. It's the same guy.
Yeah.
You know, I can't even. What I think of him, it's me. I mean, I knew I was going to be something like I am now. I was as confident then as I was a little more confident then. I was a little more confident then than I am now. But you know what? I knew the world was mine. That's it. When I was on that train, I knew I was taking over. You know, I loved crossing the U.S.-Canadian border because I remember when the trees would go from maples to willows or willows to maples. So the trees are slightly different. Just the whole, when the products change, the O. Henry bar in the States is, O. Henry's are much better in Canada. Ask all the boys over here. I love the American, North American landscape, and America's my country. I felt that way even before I had a U.S. passport. I always felt America was mine, you know, and Canada is mine. But I really think the world is ours. It's mine and it's yours, and I believe in humanity. I believe that where there's continuous improvement in how we operate as human beings. And there should be minimum standards in the playing field of business that I support. Minimum, little, you know. Like a minimum wage, but otherwise it's for each man on his own. You know, I believe that we're all employees at will, and love it or leave it, take it or shove it. You know, I mean, you don't like the job, take a hike. Like, I'm into that kind of American, you know, can-do spirit. Take the job, do it, or, you know, get another job. But I think when it comes to the lowest level, there's the minimum, to the poorest of the poor, I mean, big corporations have to pay at least a little, you know, just take care of the little man, just, you know, the most vulnerable have to be protected. These people in Bangladesh are vulnerable, and someone has to speak for them, and I think that they deserve something better than they're getting.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
All right.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.